What sets a high-performing team apart is a team that can iterate very, very quickly and can make their choices and understand their system well.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Let's get to the real work. Today, we are talking with Carlos Rosau, Director of Software Engineering at Neustore. Carlos, we're excited to have you on. You obviously have 15 years of hands-on experience as a developer and have recently moved into leadership over the past 3 to 5 years. And your experience brushes both the corporate side, working at big companies like Neustore, as well as consulting firms like Equal Experts. And so we're excited to have you on today and learn from your diversity of experience. Could you start by sharing a little bit more about what you're specifically responsible for at Neustore and maybe even what Neustore does for folks in the audience who don't know?
In very simplified terms, what Neustore does is we create an iPhone app that allows retailers to manage everything related with their stores just by using this app. If you go to one of our customer stores in the UK or in the US, instead of the people that work in the stores, you won't see them standing behind those old school point of sales behind the counter. They will be walking around the store just by using with the iPhone in their hands, and they will be able to do everything related with managing the store just by using the iPhone. So they could sell the products to me and you, or they could even fulfill an order that was placed online and it was sent to the store because this order was available in the store. So this is what Neustore's product is all about. I started in Neustore around 5 years ago, and I first started as head of engineering, responsible for two teams. Today, I'm working as a director, and I'm responsible for two big areas of the organization. One of these areas is what we call selling, which is everything that allows the workers in the store to sell using our product. And sure. The second area is payments, which is a quite common area all around the software as a service. A lot of companies have this. So these are the two big areas that we're working. We are mostly remote, so we have people spread across Europe, and we have in my reporting line, we have something like 40 to 50 people today.
Oh, wow. Very cool. And so you said you're mostly remote. Can you unpack that a little bit more? What exactly does the setup look like?
Mm-hmm. So we have three offices today, one in Berlin, other in Amsterdam, and we just opened a London office. And we have engineers working from these countries where they can go to the office, but we also have engineers working in other countries in Europe. Our rule of thumb has always been hiring really strong people independently of the country, as long as they are more or less on the CET time zone. And by more or less, I mean plus one, minus 1 hour. Even though people are remotely, we want people to work collaboratively, to work together for as much time of the day as possible. If people would have 8 hours time zone difference, this would be quite hard, but having 1 hour time zone difference, this is quite easy. Because the teams do pair programming a lot, so by default, mm-hmm. The people are working in pair programming. So with 8 hours time zone difference, that would be pretty much impossible.
So you're maximizing for time zone overlap independent of where anyone is actually physically based. And it sounds exactly. Like you've got some in-person offices that folks can optionally go to. Is there any required in-person attendance, or is it totally optional?
No, it's optional. There's no requirement. It's optional. And what we try to do is try to get people together, example, at least once a quarter or at the beginning of one. Imagine if we're building one new functionality starting early next year, we would get all the people involved in one office for kickoff and guarantee that everyone is on the same page. And this also helps ensure that people have a face-to-face connection here and there to make sure that that's not lost. At the same time, all the offices do once a month team get together. It's not mandatory or anything, but the office was better. There's food ordered, and there's even sometimes meetups, and people go there once a month. In places where we don't have offices, but we have a considerable number of people, we do the same. Example, in Lisbon, which is where I am today, once a month we do a team get together, and I just rent a co-working space, and we get all the team here. They're in the co-working space for the full day.
It sounds like there is a pretty strong priority on synchronous time, both remotely and in person. And you talked a little bit about the moments in which getting together in person feels like a higher priority. Could you talk a little bit about how the organization or you in leadership think about what are the right moments to bring people together in person and what you're seeking to do when you actually get in person?
In terms of goals of getting people together, I think we can summarize those goals by one, making sure the human face-to-face relation is not lost, so that we are just more than faces on a screen, so that people get to know each other face-to-face, including also having lunch together, having dinner together, so that people also have this human contact beyond just a face on the screen. At the same time, the goal of the face-to-face meetings is also to make sure that everything is ready to start or to kick off a new project. Example, we want to run a user story mapping session before starting a significant project. It's important to do this face-to-face because this will allow everyone to be in the same room and everyone to have a better understanding and also be able to question it there right at the beginning. Of course, this could be achieved remotely, but I think at least when we start something, it's very valuable to have this face-to-face communication. We try to do this once a quarter, and this helps when we have new members in the team. When there are new members in the team, we ensure that at least once a quarter, a new member gets to know the rest of the team in person. This also, I think, helps with onboarding and helps also people feel part of a larger group and not just being isolated, if we can call it.
NewStore seems to really prioritize getting that in-person time together. Could you describe maybe the team's culture and what it feels like to work as an engineer at NewStore?
I think it's important to clarify what you just said. We give a lot of value to in-person contact, but not every day. We don't mandate people to be in the office every day.
Right.
I think it's important to
good clarification.
To clarify that. Now, what is the environment like at NewStore? We are organized around what I call empowered teams. Some literature also calls this streamlined teams, which are teams around a given domain or vertical. And these teams are fully responsible for this vertical, from ideas all the way to taking these ideas to production. And independently of what technology or what are your part of the system requires to be implemented this idea. We have one area of the system, which is the shopping cart. We call this the checkout team. So everything related with the shopping cart, independently of it being work on front end, work on back end, or even work on infrastructure, this is done by this team. And this team is the one responsible to, one, speak with customers and understand with customers and understand also from the market and the business what is more important to expecting of the organization, prioritize it, getting it done and validated with real users if our original hypothesis were the right one. So in summary, I think the working as an engineer at NewStore is something that makes people feel very empowered to make changes on today to day. Contrary to other places I've seen, engineers will not be told, do this, do that, do this, here's the task, go and do it. People are way more empowered to make decisions of what's more important for that specific area of the business. Of course, these are not just engineers. These streamlined or empowered teams include other roles like product managers, UX designers, and if needed, more people. But together, they partner and build this part of the product as a group, as a team. So in general, working at NewStore, I think it feels a very collaborative environment, very close with the end users, which usually are very, very receptive to working closely with us because they end up getting early access to new functionalities and they feel that their voice is heard when we are building new things. Because if they are there from the start with us, they can say, oh, we would love it to be a bit more like this. Or this problem that you're trying to solve is good, but this other problem is probably more important. So something like this. And this interaction between customers and the teams is very, very powerful for me. We also do face-to-face time with customers. Our customers are, like I was saying at the beginning, they are mostly retailers, so they have stores.
Sure.
And here and there, we try to get the teams in the stores and work as if they were one of the users of our product. Because
Yeah, totally.
So you need to read your own blog post, right? So you need to to understand exactly how it is. Customers don't have stores in all the countries in the world. For example, we have there's a few stores in Berlin, there's a few stores in London, and there's hundreds of stores across the US. And here and there, we do these store visits, and we even have situations where our engineers work in the stores as if they were one of the store employees. This is we've been trying to have this as part of the onboarding. This is not there yet, but this is one of the goals that I want to bring to the organization, is that as part of the onboarding.
You shared before the show at a different conversation than where you and I were catching up that New Store's been trying to standardize a bunch of practices across the engineering team as well. So there's this dichotomy between some practice standardization and independent team autonomy and empowerment. Could you talk to me a little bit about what are the practices that New Store is standardizing or has standardized around? What practices do you feel like set the team up to collaborate and work together so effectively while being remote?
What I described in terms of having close contact with the people that use our product, this is part of something that we feel is so important that we want it to be a standard across the organization.
Sure.
So in terms of, we can call this product engineering or whatever you want to call it, customer focus, customer first, this kind of thing, this is one of the most important things. And I believe that this is at the top of the things that we've standardize across the teams in the organization.
Okay.
From a more technical or more ways of working perspective, we've also brought forward the standardization around pair programming, test-driven development, and a few other things around the extreme programming. The reason for this is that we believe that these practices encourage a set of behaviors and encourage a set of quality in the code and in the things we build that is exactly what we need. Example, pair programming together with pair rotation ensures that we have as little knowledge silos in the teams as possible, so that if people get sick or if people end up paying on parental leave, or if people leave the organization, the impact on the teams is smaller because you don't have the same person always working on the same kind of functionality, because this person is the person that knows more about this and they will always work on this. It can seem very effective at first, but this will be, as the time goes by, you will be fully dependent on this person for that particular part of the code, and you will work. Like I usually say to my colleagues, this is a marathon, this is not a sprint, so you're here for the long run, as we need to optimize for the long run and not optimize for what's easy and what is faster today. I mentioned also test-driven development, and this is a way of, one, not just ensuring quality as the tests are in place, but test-driven development can also be used as a design tool, as a way to guide design and guide architecture choices, because if you want to start by writing the tests, you need to build your software in a way that's easily testable. And doing that makes your code also easy to change. So there's a bunch of self-reinforcing things that together, they contribute to a product that it's stronger, easier to change, and to a team that feels more comfortable doing the changes in the source code. One of the most common problems in software industry is miscommunication. And when you're talking instead of just writing, it's easier to understand exactly what the person is trying to say. If you're talking constantly with someone and working together with the person or with the team the full day, you have the opportunity to clarify when you misunderstand something. And it's cheaper to misunderstand something because you can clarify it easily because the person is there on the call with you.
That's so interesting, because miscommunication is one of the things that I hear is one of the most prevalent challenges of working remotely. And what I'm hearing you say is that your practice of pair programming 8 hours a day is your primary approach to preventing that miscommunication. Am I hearing that right?
That is part of it. I think the other part is ensuring that teams are empowered to make their own decisions, which then leads to less communication needing to happen, let's put it like this, or I mean less communication back and forth, because if the team can set their own goals. But to be able to set these goals, the teams need to have clarity on what is the business trying to do from a general perspective, because the team's goals and what the team tries to do with their part of the platform needs to bubble up to the company-wide objective. Let's say the company needs to grow 5 times this year as a random example. The team then figures out what they can do with their part of the system or with their area or their domain to be able to lead the business as a whole to achieve this. If it's not clear for the team what is the business goals, the team can communicate well within their area, and they can execute quite well and choose good problems within that area, but they might not be doing the most important thing for the business. So I think for the communication or miscommunication to be less prevalent in a remote kind of environment, I think it's important to, one, have the business goals clear to everyone and not just clear to the leadership team. Make sure that this is clear throughout the organization. There are, let's say, rallying cries and other kind of techniques that help with this. And then make sure that the team is empowered to make their decisions to get there. Because if the decisions are just top-down, this will be quite hard and there will be a lot of back and forth that then lead to miscommunication, I believe.
It's nice to talk about this stuff in theory. I think it's often more illustrative to provide specific examples of decisions or projects that were led with autonomy to help folks understand what this really means in practice, because I am sure that over the course of your career, you've seen it done the other way, right? Where teams were not autonomous or not given that level of autonomy and empowerment to go out and do things themselves. So could you share a specific story?
I can give an example, and I can go back to the same area we were talking before, the area of the shopping cart. So
yeah, let's do it.
One example from, I imagine this was already last year, so the time flows quite fast, but I remember that we, as an organization, we were struggling with one area, which is a POS point of sale with this part. This part was not being a differentiator as we wanted to be, and this was causing us to lose new deals, as in prospects were not signing as much as we wanted. And so as part of what we can call it rallying cry, or can even call it objective, or one of the company business goals was, let's make POS great again. Of course, there was two metrics to help everyone understand what this means. But there was no saying, you need now to go and do this, you need now to go and do this, and you need now to go and do this. The different teams then were empowered to make their own choices. And one of the examples from the shopping cart team was that we understood that the checkout process was too long, was taking quite a long time. And the team invested a lot of effort on reducing this time, and they did this by making some steps more lean, as intuitive for the user, and actually even removing some other steps. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of data, remove the average from 1 minute and 20 seconds to something like 30 seconds.
Oh.
And in terms of the customer satisfaction grew by 30% in this area. From a business perspective, this was perfect. This was amazing. This was what we want. But there was no top-down saying, now go and build this feature. The team was empowered to decide for this specific part of the product, what do we need to do? I usually end up saying, which is, when you treat people like adults, and they behave like adults. And if you're hiring smart people, give them direction and give them guardrails, but let them make decisions for their part. If you're just hiring smart people and telling them what to do, they will just be frustrated, and because you will just be robots, and no one wants to be a robot, right?
Yeah, of course. And finding that balance is tough. It sounds like what Nestor does is there's sort of this high level objective, something to the effect of make POS great again, with some supporting metrics, but no direction on what projects or tasks or features should be delivered against in order to improve the metrics. Am I understanding that right?
On team level and not on company level.
Right.
Of course, there are situations where it requires several teams, but there's always one team that is the driver or the initiator of this, and then there's required collaboration, and then we get this done collaboratively between two or three different teams if needed.
I always like to ask folks about the highest performing team that they've ever been on, because I find that every person I speak to, even outside these interviews, has a single point of reference for that one team that sort of set the standard in their mind for what great looks like. And so when I talk about this, what is that team for you, and what was that experience?
What sets a high-performing team apart is a team that can iterate very, very quickly and can make their choices and understand their system well, and can iterate based, one, on the customer feedback, and two, on the analytics that we're getting from the customer usage, and three, on the system itself and how the system is behaving, and where are the bottlenecks that we need to fix. A team that can do this constantly, and by constantly I mean every day, all the time, can be a very, very high-performing team. In order to get here, there's a lot of things required, but a team that can do this is, in my perspective, is a high-performing team. The first time in my career that I saw something of this sort was in my previous job at Equal Experts, and ever since then that helped me guide my thought process around what is an effective team and how to build an effective team. And the practices I mentioned before contribute a lot, the practices around pair programming, around test-driven development, and taking this one step further to trunk-based development and continuous deployment to production, of course, as long as the tests are green. All this ensures that committing code and deploying code is like a second thought. You don't need to think if you're going to break anything or not. You are so confident that you can do a deploy at 6 p.m. on Friday because you are confident that it's either going to, the tests are green and it's going to production, or the test will catch the failure and it won't go to production and you will fix the failure without impacting anyone in production. This is how a high-performing team looks like. It doesn't matter where people are, if they are remote or if they are in office. I think the impact of that is less. What I think is important is that people are happy and they feel that they have an impact on the day-to-day of the team. And they also feel that they can make their own choices on where they work. By that, I mean, it's okay to have an office, but please don't force people to go there. Give the option, and the people that want to go there, they go, and the people that don't want, don't go. And when we want to get people together, like we were talking at the beginning, we will get people together and we use the office for it. But don't force people to do what they don't want to do, because when you do something like that, you will lose the best. Following this and trying to get to this state is what I try to do with all the teams I've ever worked with ever since then.
Yeah. But was it like that in Eastar when you joined?
No, not at all. It was very different from that. One of the things that I've also learned throughout these years is that if you want to transform a team, you really need a critical mass in the team that understands what good looks like in terms of what you were talking. Because if you don't have a critical mass understanding this, it's really, really hard to do the change and do the change in a way that it sticks, that it doesn't just disappear the moment you look the other way. Of course, you can do that progressively. You can have critical mass in one team, train people, and then start moving people to the second team and so on and so forth. If you want to do a transformation like this and you want to remove 50 or 60% of the organization, you end up destroying the organization. And that's unrealistic, to be honest.
Totally. Where do you start? Like, what practices or...
It's not the customer that is telling us that there are problems in the system. It's not the customer screaming, hey, things are not working. And we say, oh, really? We didn't notice that. So I start by making sure that we really know what's wrong with the system before the customer does. In order to do this, you need to have proper dashboards, you need to have proper instrumentation on the apps you use, you need to have proper monitoring and alarms on the different microservices or whatever you are using in the in your system. Once you have this, you start to understand where the bottlenecks are, and you have a better understanding of where the problems are. And this also allows you to, when you do change, you can more or less understand where the problem. Second, I start bringing people that have a very good understanding of what good looks like in my perspective in terms of quality standards. In general, things that lead to software that is easy to change. And once we start doing this progressively, we will start building a proper test coverage. When you have a proper test coverage around one part, you can use what's usually called the strangler pattern, and you can isolate one part of the system and start doing changes there. And the tests make sure that all the changes you are doing, as long as the tests are green, they are not destroying or they are not impacting the rest of the system. And you start this progressively, and if you have a critical mass in the team, this critical mass can help coach the rest of the members in the team in order until you have a proper confidence and you are deploying software to production every day, you are validating with users every day. And then you use this as an example team and you start spreading these practices and this culture to the team next door and so on and so forth.
You mentioned that to drive some of these changes, having a critical mass is your number one thing. Mm-hmm. And that one of the primary tactics for doing so is bringing in people who know what great looks like. Imagine you're not in a situation where you have a direct influence over the hiring piece. How would you approach some of this stuff?
If I would not have influence on the hiring process, I would try to lead by example or try to lead by showing what good looks like to people around me and to people that have an influence on how the hiring process looks like. You try to do that by showing that it works. It's not theoretical, it actually works. You can start influencing the people that can make the decisions and start to be part of the hiring process too. I didn't say something before, but it's important that when you're doing this transformation you were speaking, you are hiring for the transformation you want. You are hiring for the culture you want. You are hiring for the standards you want, not for the standards you have. Because you are changing this. And it's important that you are strict, very strict in terms of who you are. Because sometimes you really meet someone fast, but it's tempting to just hire the first person because, oh, I need someone, it doesn't matter, but it's damaging. It's damaging when you are trying to do a transformation and then you end up hiring the people that are not going to be a change driver.
I often find in my own experience that it's harder to identify that you've made a bad hire in a remote context than it is in person because things are less glaring. Like people can fly under the radar longer. And so I would just double highlight what you mentioned for that.
In an environment where the team is working in a very collaborative fashion, where there's pair programming running all the time, and a lot of situations you even have mobbing work because there's a certain problem that two people that cannot solve, or they don't know how to solve, or they want to ask feedback from more people, and the team just gets together. Situations like this, it's quite hard to fly under the radar, like you said. It's way easier when people are working completely separate and just opening pull requests for others to review.
It sounds like pairing, mobbing, working synchronously and collaboratively on code is a really central or fundamental component of the way that your team or teams get work done. And it seems very closely aligned with your personal beliefs. What is your team's approach to pairing, mobbing, working synchronously on code together?
What is part of the standards and what I encourage is that there is frequent rotation, at least twice a week. So that there's not always the same pair working on a specific task. Together with this, I also am very keen on and pushing the teams not to pre-assign tasks to people. By that, I mean is you have tasks to do before they are started to be work, and you start putting phrases there on the task just because, oh, this person knows about this, let me put this phrase here. That person knows about that, let me put that phrase there. No. In my perspective, and this is how we work very much, is when people are free, they pick the next thing on the top of to do. They don't choose. They pick the next thing on the top of to do, independently of being a support request or a user story or whatever. Doesn't really matter, independent of what area of the code it is.
Walk me through the specific process by which folks pick the work that they work on, because I imagine for most teams that don't work the way that you work, this is going to sound extremely foreign and scary to them. So let's get in fine detail. What does this look like?
So let's start from the beginning. The teams usually have stand-ups every day. And we are also very keen that the stand-ups are not a status update. The stand-ups are usually used for people to raise blockers, have blockers, and to discuss the things that have been moved to done, complete to them, to make sure that this is moved to done, there's communication needed with that team, if you can help me with that, something like that. Not to say, I did this yesterday, I did that yesterday, I don't care. The board should say what people were doing. And in the end, I don't care if person A was working on task A or person B was working on task B, I really don't care. What I usually also say is that the minimum unit of ownership should be the team and not an individual person. We own our code as a team. It's not an individual person owning certain parts of the code. It's the team. The ownership is on the team. When there's an incident, the ownership is on the team. It's not an individual person. And we celebrate when we do mistakes, and when we do good things, we celebrate together. It's not individual. It's important to have pair rotation. So I'm going to give the example where certain teams have pair rotation sheets, where they say, imagine Monday and Tuesday, person A is pairing with person B, and person C is pairing with person D. Wednesday and Thursday, person A is pairing with person C, and person B is pairing with person D, something like this. So imagine person A and person B on Monday, they have nothing to do because they have finished their work on Friday. They start working on the first task that is on the to-do list, and they move it to in progress. They work on this. They get to the end of Tuesday. If for some reason they haven't finished this work, one of these people continues with the task, and the other leaves and moves to the other pair and the other one. And we want to make sure that there is one person from the original pair that continues in the task, and there's one new person coming and rotating, so that not all the knowledge of the work done so far is lost. And when people finish, they move it to done. And by finish, I mean all tests are run. This is deployed to production. It's running in production. It's working properly in production. And I don't mean done. It was sent to someone else to review. I mean done is done in production, running with real users. We have this as part of the definitions of that. And then people just pick the next task on the top of the tier. For this to work well, you just need to ensure that your to-do list is updated and ordered by priority top-down.
Who manages the to-do list?
The team. Of course, usually the manager, the engineering manager, and the product manager, and the UX designer. I usually say they have kind of the first level of priority, but the priority is decided by the team as a whole. Certain teams do sessions once a week to guarantee that this is up to date. But for very mature teams, they do this every day. Example, they can do this every day, right after the end of the stand-up, just a few minutes, like, hey, this is out of date. It's not, oh, I think this one is more important because this customer is screaming or something is happening, so let's move it to the top. So they'll kind of get the team does.
And they'll do that publicly during stand-up?
Yes, publicly during stand-up. And the board is open, or imagine right. During the day, oh, there is this fire happening. We really need to move this to the top of to do. I'm going to do this, and what do you think? Something like this. Like I said, people are adults. They are not children. They want the best for the product. They are not playing around. So, if you trust them, they'll come back and do way better than what you expect at first.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And obviously, you've gotten your team set up in a way that they're operating very effectively. I want to repeat back some of the stuff that I heard to make sure I understand it right. So your teams, they'll have a daily stand-up that's centered around identifying blockers, not focused on status updates, right? Because as you said, that's not something you specifically care about. Everybody does work in pairs. The pairs switch at least twice a week. When assigning work. There is no process for assigning work, right? There's a process for managing the priorities in the to-do list. And as folks finish their tasks deployed to production with live users, they just grab the next thing on the list. And that just happens continuously. And pairs rotate in and out, independent of whether or not an individual piece of work is done. It just happens as it happens. Am I understanding all of that? Yes. All of that right?
Yeah, exactly. This requires a level of ownership and a level of maturity, but it works quite well. Everyone can work on everything. It ensures that
totally.
If there's work on backend, anyone can do it. If there's work in frontend, anyone can do it. It doesn't matter. And of course, there's people with more expertise than others in certain areas, but hey, this is a team. If you need help, speak up. No one will blame you because you need help. No one here is an expert on everything. So if you need help, you speak up.
When you started at NewStore, was everybody also remote and distributed in the way that they are today?
No, when I started, this was before a few months before COVID, and everyone was in the office. When COVID hit, people were forced to work from home, as you remember. I had some experience in remote work because of technical experts, it was remote first. And so I ended up helping and guiding the engineers and beyond that on best practices to work remote.
What are some of the best practices that come to mind to you that you feel like every remote team should absolutely consider?
A lot of these practices, they don't just apply to remote work, but I think they take remote work itself to the next level. One is make the work visible. Make sure that there is no invisible work. So everything that the team is doing is part of the team's work. Because if you don't see something, you cannot manage it. You cannot understand if there's bottlenecks. You cannot understand if there's problems. If person B has been working on the same thing for 2 weeks, and they are just working, but it's not part of the board, how can you make sure that that doesn't happen? Or how can you make sure that other people are available to help? So on. So one is make work visible. Two is make sure that the pair programming is in place, because that helps a lot, I think, also with remote work. And then there's a few things that are very small things that I believe are quite helpful in a remote environment. One is make sure that the person has their face on all the tools we use. Example, Slack. It's very funny when people have some Bart Simpson or some other character on their instead of their picture. But sure. If you never saw someone, this is quite hard. You need to remember that person A is Bart Simpson and person B is Darth Vader or whatever. That becomes a mess in a remote environment. So make sure that people have their face in Slack, in Confluence, in Jira, whatever. Also, make sure that people really manage their calendar properly. If there's a meeting schedule, respond to it. It's okay to say no, but respond to it. Just don't leave it nothing. And if you're going out on holidays or you're out sick or something, make sure that your status is updated on Slack saying that you're out for holidays until day X and your calendar is also out of office, and the same for your email. Make sure that no one is looking for you. And they know that you're out. It's not that you cannot be out or anything like that. It's just important so that people know what to expect. These very small things make sure that remote work works well. And then there are other more high-level things. Example, when we have meetings, if there's a person that is working remotely, let's make sure that we all act as if we are all are remote. Example, right. There's five people in the room and one or two at home. Let's all just open our laptops and make a call as if everyone is at home. Because if not, the two people that are remote will have a terrible experience.
Right.
So it's kind of, and when you're in video calls, turn your camera on. Make sure that your camera is on and not just off, because it makes it a lot easier to communicate when you see the other person's face. So all these simple things go a long way to make remote work work.
that's what the show is all about. So I appreciate you opining on it. And a lot of what you said is stuff I've heard from a handful of others. And so it sort of reinforces this message that doing the simple things to keep information flowing between people, you know, we talk about it at Tuple as keeping the garage, working with the garage door open so that everybody is aware of what everybody else is doing, where people are, what they're up to, makes a huge difference. And that any barrier between having a personal human connection, for example, having an emoji or a fake avatar as your face in Slack or any of the other tools, or not having your webcam on, should be removed, right? Like you need to do the things to establish more of a human connection when you aren't working together face to face.
You were speaking about couple. I see examples every day, right? Someone's, as an engineer, arrives early and he just says, oh, I'm in tuple room X. When you come, just join me there. I'll be there starting this part. When you start working, just join me here. So people have these public rooms and anyone can join. So this works really, really well.
Thank you, Carlos. I really appreciate you spending your time with us and being generous with your insights. If folks would like to connect with you personally or learn more about NewStore, where should they go?
They can find me on LinkedIn, I also have a Substack called Tales of Engineering Leadership .substack.com, so people also can help me there. I wrote a few posts about some of the things we spoke here, about remote work, about high performing engineering practices, and so on.
Very good. Well, thank you again, Carlos. Appreciate you being here.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @TupleOnX or visit distributed.fm.